could start to see that like certain people were having all of their time sucked up by folks who needed just like one-off help. And so we really had to think about, as we grew this team, and this team was responsible for everything, how do we actually figure out how to scale helping people with how to use these tools most effectively while still like shielding my team and giving them space to grow and actually like build new services and new functionality. So we were growing really quickly when I started. The rest of engineering was growing really fast. And that, I think, posed a really interesting challenge.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast that helps software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Jill Wetzler. Jill Wetzler is the head of engineering at Pilot. Before that, she scaled Lyft's infrastructure engineering org from a handful to over 100 infrastructure engineers. She was also eventually Lyft's director of engineering leadership development. In this episode, we talk about the principles Jill has used to develop leaders. These tactics range from skip level 101s to developer advocacy. We also dive into the management issues that can hold underrepresented individual contributors back and what we can do to fix those issues. Right now, we're in a challenging period for engineering leaders. That's why I'm dedicating time to answer questions about engineering leadership. If you have questions about building and managing a remote team, email me at wes@woventeams.com and I'll try to help you out. Again, that's wes@woventeams.com so I can help answer your questions or direct you to folks that can. Let's talk about growing and managing a remote team. And now, here's my conversation with Jill Wetzler. Jill, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you built the infrastructure engineering org at Lyft. Could you tell us what that engineering org looked like when you got started and how that growth went?
Yeah, when I started managing the DevOps team, and you could start to see that like certain people were having all of their time sucked up by folks who needed just like one-off help. And so we really had to think about, as we grew this team, and this team was responsible for everything, how do we actually figure out how to scale helping people with how to use these tools most effectively while still like shielding my team and giving them space to grow and actually like build new services and new functionality. So we were growing really quickly when I started. The rest of engineering was growing really fast. And that, I think, posed a really interesting challenge pretty much throughout the 3 years that I was running this team, was like, how do I find ways to build this team with the proper ratio to the rest of engineering while still giving myself and my own team like time to adjust to all of the like new processes and the new growth that was coming up. So the approach there was essentially like hire engineers as fast as I could and then start to figure out what are the distinct teams that we could pull out. So I think the very first team that we pulled out was an observability and monitoring team, because we were really doing a hard push at that point on having strong SLAs, making sure that we had good monitoring and alarming in place, and really putting a push on reliability and quality.
You mentioned earlier the ratio. What was the ratio you were targeting of infrastructure DevOps engineers to the rest of the org?
It tended to vary. We were shooting for something in the 10 to 15% range. Depending on what companies you look at, that seems to be where they settle, but it also depends on how you define infrastructure. So at Lyft, the data infrastructure org was not part of my org. That was something that was separate. We had experimented a couple of times of having mobile infra roll up into infra versus having it roll up into its own mobile org. And so those things would change, but we were always aiming for something in the like 10 to 15% range, especially as we were doing headcount planning once the org was larger. So then we were starting to look at like just giving like buckets of headcount to certain orgs, and then I would be able to disperse those how I saw fit.
I would love to learn more about kind of what you did to scope teams and kind of lessons you learned about as you're growing fast and, you know, kind of evolving that organization. What are some better and worse ways to scope teams?
I think the biggest lesson I learned throughout this whole growth process was making sure that I need to be in front of my manager hiring. The moment that I think I might need a manager 3 months out, I need to start building a pipeline. So that caused a lot of strain. I think it limited what I could do with the org. Like, how can I split out a team if I don't necessarily have somebody to lead it? So there were definitely some points where I had tech leads that were taking on probably more management related tasks than I would normally like for a tech lead to take on. All of my tech leads were having one-on-ones with folks on their teams. So that was one of the biggest things. In terms of the actual logistics of like scoping teams, a lot of this actually came from my engineers themselves. So just listening to folks telling me that like the team boundaries weren't working, that it was causing a heavy support load on one team versus another, that there was one team that was kind of this catch-all, that everything was falling to them. And so I leaned on my leads for this. We got in a room and we wrote out, okay, for developer infrastructure, which was just a portion of my org. So developer infra is anything that engineers are using to deploy, test, develop, et cetera, get their code into production. We spent some time on a whiteboard and just wrote out, okay, what is everything that all of these teams own? And let's forget about the existing team lines that we have and let's redraw some new ones. So what are the things that can be logically grouped together? Out of this exercise, we decided to form a team that was solely focused on the developer experience and supporting people's developer environments, making sure that our front-end developers had the same amount of support that our back-end developers had, et cetera. And then I asked each of these leads to go away and come back with a defined team charter. So that's something that actually took with me into my current role at Pilot. When we recently just did this sort of shuffle, we have about 25 engineers. Everybody's like working on whatever project is important for the quarter, but that's not durable. They're not staying and working on the same project or the same area of the product for a long period of time. So around Q1, we did the same thing. We did a rechartering exercise. And we actually did this kind of bottoms up. We gave some overall guidance to product and to our engineering leads, and we chose our tech leads for the teams as well. But then we had the teams go away and write their own charter and their own, we had a section for like what's in scope for this team and what's out of scope for this team, so that it's very clear to everybody. So I like having these documents that define like what is a team's mission statement, who are their customers, what is in scope for them, what's out of scope. I think it goes a long way, especially like when you start to have other teams that are asking questions and maybe they want to know like what's the right team to talk to. We can point them to the charter so that they have a good understanding of how we're organized.
So a charter has, I heard, what's the mission of this team? Who are the customers? And the customers often internal, it sounds like, at least for infrastructure perspective.
For infra and actually for Pilot as well, most of our teams have internal customers because Pilot does bookkeeping and tax services for small businesses and our operations team does books on a regular basis. So the vast majority of folks at Pilot are actually focused on making our operators successful.
So the mission, customers, and then in scope. And is this like examples of work that are in scope and examples of work that are out of scope?
And then metrics are a big thing. What are the big like company metrics that this team is responsible for? So on the infrastructure side, that's going to be things like developer productivity, reliability, safety. I listened to Will Larson on the podcast talking about some of those productivity metrics and how difficult that is to get right. And then on like our operations side, the team is actually called margin and scaling. So their main focus is the margin number of the business and our ability to scale with our customer growth.
How do you measure kind of developer productivity?
Yeah, that was the just endless debate at Lyft. There are sort of the like normal metrics that you can look at with, you know, how long does it take for a PR to get to from PR to prod? And then we would break that down at all these different points. But that gets dangerous because you know, you can wind up with like, okay, why does this team, why does this team's PR to prod numbers take longer? Well, for the team that created Envoy, our service mesh, that was such a dangerous system to work in. If you weren't careful with that, you could take down all of Lyft. And so they had a deploy train and everything, you know, they had two deploys a week, maybe three. And so, you know, a PR to prod metric might look bad on that team versus a team that's like shoveling out code every day and also maybe having to do hot fixes every day. And so I think when you're in this like microservices world where teams really have a lot of control over how often they deploy, it's tough to set like one company metric on that. So we had a lot of metrics that we looked at that were more just signal for us to look in further. There were other metrics that we tracked around. I know one of our most successful quarters was we decided it was taking way too long. Sometimes it was taking on the order of a week for a new engineer to come in and like really get their system set up to where they could be fully productive and developing. Cause we have all these other like meetings that they have to go through. And then at some point you have to find time to sit down with your mentor and like get your environment set up and walk through the instructions. And so for that quarter, our goal was day one, an engineer can come in, they can pull up their phone, they can connect it to their laptop, they can take a fake Lyft ride. And that wound up being a really good metric to focus our teams around. That was like a multi-team effort. We had a team that was actually building simulated traffic that we would run in production. We had this like fake city with a bunch of fake cars driving around and a bunch of fake passengers taking rides. And we would like ramp that up on a regular basis to do our load testing. And so we made use of this for our developer testing story, which was being able to set up an environment that has fake drivers, being able to put your phone in the same location and then request a ride. And so those were the types of metrics that we would look at on a regular basis. And then we also had all these other like focus groups and things that we would like talk to engineers about to get their feedback on.
What are some other metrics that you...
The focus groups were better than the surveys. The other things we would look at is really like specific to the reliability of the systems that we maintained. So like how fast does CI run? Does CI go down? So tracking SLAs, like we talked a lot about thinking about infrastructure as a product and as a product team with customers. And, you know, the thing is like, if an engineering team at Lyft really, really wanted to like go buy their own CI service, you know, it probably would have launched a huge debate, but like if it were the right thing for that team to do, then they would have done it. And so I was always asking my team to think about like, what is the value prop? Like, why should people use our CI system? Is it just because like, well, it's here and they kind of have to? That's not a good reason. Like, can we give them SLA and performance numbers? Because if somebody's going to go buy Circle CI is going to give them, SLAs. So we had to think about ourselves from that perspective, like give people an actual reason to want to use our tools. And then like, what are the metrics that we can show them so that they can feel confident using our tools? So we would look at things like, you know, time to rollback, rate of rollback also. But again, like these metrics, you have to be really careful about how you use them. And I think using them as a signal to go get more information or a signal to say that like, oh, something is off is the best use. Because otherwise, you know, if you're trying to say we want to reduce the number of rollbacks, that might discourage somebody from rolling back a change that really should be rolled back. Instead, they want to do a fix forward and they put the system at risk again. And so there were a lot of metrics that we were tracking that we were trying to pull down, but it, you know, there was always some story behind it. So if we were like presenting like why our rollback percentage went down, but not as much as you would like to see, we would have to have like good anecdotes behind it for like why this metric is, you know, something we should handle delicately.
Were these stories mostly useful to talk to management, to other teams? Where did you find those stories useful to explain those metrics?
I think that was mostly for executives. You know, I remember having a conversation with one of our execs about code reviews. You know, why focusing so much on code review time is probably not the right metric for us to focus on at our level. Like, we should surface code review time to teams. If there are teams that are taking like a week to do code reviews, it's probably not good. But that's also like data that I would rather have in the hands of managers. And so that managers can figure out how are their teams actually performing? Does productivity feel right on their team? And then what do the metrics say about that? It gets a little dangerous if we're trying to draw conclusions at an exec level about what any individual team or any individual team member is doing and like why their metrics look a certain way.
So you you changed roles at some point after leading the infrastructure team. What was that new role like?
The last year that I was at Lyft, I had pitched this role to our founders and to our head of HR. And I had kind of become this person in engineering that like that folks went to when they had issues that they didn't know how to work through. So it was like kind of typical like mentorship related stuff. Like I had office hours, and word would get out and someone would like come up, you know, come up against some issue on their team and somebody would say, oh, go talk to Jill. And so then they would hop in my office hours and we'd have a conversation about it. I've also been doing diversity and inclusion work, you know, ever since I could breathe. Definitely like when I first got into computing and I looked around and I was like, oh, wow, I'm like one of the only women here. And so I've been doing a lot of work in these spaces. And the more that I've done this, the more I've come to the conclusion that like where we're failing is we're actually failing our first line managers. And that whole transition process can be so bumpy for folks. And the people that you're learning from, unless you're really good at going out and like getting a bunch of mentors and like connections and people who can help you through all of your various issues, you're probably just looking to your own manager for guidance or like the, you know, couple adjacent managers who are also in your org. And, you know, we're running up against very different issues from each other all the time. People are so unpredictable. Everybody has different needs and passions and interests and problems. And so if the only place that you can go to for advice is your manager, you may not be getting the best advice possible.
As long as that your situations are exactly the same, you'll probably get great advice.
Exactly. Right. But I participate in a lot of these like peer manager circles. And the example that I always give is like, we've all dealt with a smart asshole, but everybody's smart asshole that they've dealt with is different from the next. And like some of the tactics that work for one person will not work for another because you have to understand what your smart asshole's motivations are. And so I think this is like our biggest opportunity. When I talk to underrepresented people who are stuck, a lot of times it's because their manager just doesn't understand them, doesn't understand what they're struggling with, doesn't take their, you know, their concerns seriously when they say that like, oh, this process is supposed to work for everybody, but it doesn't work for me. And here's why. And so I really felt like we needed more focus on managers. We had a great learning and development team that was developing a lot of management content, but like, where is the focus on first-time managers and their very specific problems and conundrums that they run up against? And so I had this idea that, and a lot of this came after working with my executive coach and thinking about like, what are the things that I'm uniquely positioned to do in the company? And I was straddling this fine line of like, engineers, for the most part, seemed to trust me and to not, you know, to view me as like their ally in the like sort of executive or like senior leadership group. And at the same time, like I had built up a team. I had built credibility in the org. The other directors that I worked with generally trusted me. A lot of managers reached out to me. And so I was just in this position where I felt like I could really help people with their individual sort of problems that they were coming up against, and that we could like figure out ways to build leadership development workshops and courses and experiences that were also specific to how we become good, inclusive leaders. And as our teams get increasingly diverse, how do we figure out how to manage in that environment? Because things get tougher and conversations get riskier. And, you know, you need to have a vocabulary built up in somebody that you can talk to and like lean on if you think you may have done something wrong. And so that was the ultimate direction that I was trying to take things. So there was a little mix of like doing sort of group feedback workshops, running some diversity and inclusion related programs that were really focused on like the promo process, and then a lot of one-on-one mentoring of managers and engineers as well.
Kind of sounds like this is a little coarse, but it's like what engineers hoped HR would be if engineers trusted HR. And that's probably like an overstatement.
You're not wrong about that. And I think that's like sort of the unfortunate thing about HR. Like, I love HR. I've always had good relationships with my HR people. And I think there's also, you know, when people say HR exists to protect the company, not to protect you, like, okay, there's truth to that. A very good HR person understands that protecting the employee is protecting the company. And so at the same time, like, it's hard to be HR and to listen to, you know, the things that engineers talk about and all the jargon and the vocabulary. And, you know, one of the things I would do is like, I would look over somebody's PIP. And so let's say they're not performing, they're put on a performance improvement plan. And, you know, people would bring them to me and I would say, okay, well, let's take a look at these things that you're being measured on. And sometimes I would find these inconsistencies that you don't think an HR person would necessarily know. So like, let's say, okay, you need to close 17 story points in a week. Okay, how many story points is everybody else closing in a week? Let's go look at that on your team board. And oh, that's funny. Like, a lot of people don't actually consistently log their story points. So how is this like a fair metric? And so then we would like go make sure that the metrics were like much more clear on the team. But those are, you know, I think an HR person looking at that might say like, oh, great, a quantitative measure. This is perfect. And sort of move on. So I think there is a lot of context to where like somebody like me can work in conjunction with HR. And HR was probably the business function that I worked most closely with throughout the time that I had this role.
So you did this role for a year. It sounds like it's kind of groundbreaking. It's new. So what did you learn about building that kind of program?
I think one thing I really, really wanted was some actual HR training, because I had essentially put myself in a situation where people could bring potentially very sensitive complaints and concerns to me. And thankfully, I didn't have to deal with anything that was like too spicy. But that training, I think, would have been important. You know, one thing that I've been pitching for a very long time is this idea of an advocate or like an ombuds person who's in your org. There are lots of companies that have tried variations of this, but I would love to have, you know, a set of trained leaders in the company, a very diverse group, so that like if something's happening to you and you don't know who to go to or you're afraid to go to HR for whatever reason, that you have somebody who looks like you that you can reach out to. And the example that I give for this is like every time I come in the building, somebody thinks that I'm the kitchen staff and they try to hand me their trash. It's like you can take that complaint to HR, but like what is HR going to do about it? It's like they're going to dismiss it as a one-off, even though it is pretty important. And even if they feel bad for you, it's like, well, okay, they can go say something to like the one person who handed you your trash, but does that really fix the systemic problem? And so it's easier to just not say anything and to just weather these microaggressions, when if we really had a program where, you know, where people could talk to me about how like they walk into a room as an engineer and someone thinks they're recruiting, let me tell you how many times that's happened to me. And so it's, you know, it's like an opportunity to like share your concern, feel that you're not alone. I can give you tactics for how I deal with being, you know, mistaken for recruiting. But then I can also surface that issue to HR. And it's like not a thing that HR needs to follow up on, but it's something they should be aware of. And if it starts to happen, you know, over and over again, we start to see a pattern, like now we have something that we can address as a company. So that was always sort of my goal. I think the hard thing is, how do you do that when you still have a day job that you have to do as well? And so there was something that was very freeing about creating this role and like freeing myself up from all of these other responsibilities that I had so that I could like serve the rest of the org too.
Speaking of a day job, so you're now head of engineering at Pilot. You're 20-something engineer, so probably similar to a lot of folks listening. What are some things you've learned about managing managers and individual contributors from that role where you were, you know, just focused on it, now that you're at a small organization without all those resources?
It has been an adjustment period for sure. And it's interesting now, like being in a place where I'm the boss. And like, I really don't have a lot of like engineering leaders that are like within arm's distance of me that I can reach out to. There's certainly things that I can learn from the two managers who work for me. And there are things that I can learn from my boss, but I no longer have this like large network. So I have to rely pretty heavily on my external mentors and the network that I've built up over the years. I think there's also like, I'm really treating this opportunity at Pilot to like, okay, let me build things right from the beginning. So there's always that anytime you go to a new place, especially if you're like starting a new team, you get that opportunity to like, okay, let me lean on everything that I've seen that worked and the stuff I saw that didn't work and do this right the first time.
What are some of those things that you're able to do right from the beginning since you've seen what happens if they maybe don't get right at the start?
My biggest focus is on feedback, 100%. I have worked in too many organizations and too many places where, you know, it's not safe to give feedback up the chain. It's not even worth your time to give feedback up the chain because what good is it going to do? And I have really come into this job with like a heightened level of self-awareness. And I'm trying to convey that to folks as well.
Why is it worth spending all that time for skip levels?
I mean, it's just always made me better. I mean, first of all, like I get a tighter feedback loop on what I'm doing or on what the managers in my org are doing as well. So it makes us better. They have great ideas. This is like the time for me to hear their ideas and like things that I should be worried about that I'm not necessarily thinking about. I'd rather worry about those things now than wait for them to blow up. And then I really have a problem on my hands and then I don't have time to deal with it. So I think that's worth the time. And the other thing is just, I mean, don't you want to work in an org where you have, you know, a communication line up the chain?
You are slowly teaching folks that it's safe to be give feedback. Can you talk about how you make it clear that it's safe and how we might accidentally break that trust?
So I'm very strategic in how I ask for feedback and how I respond to it. I ask for feedback in 1,000 different ways, and some of them you might not even see. I will ask for feedback through other people. I've actually been explicit that, okay, I just had to deliver a tough message to the org. If you have feedback on this or you have questions or concerns, ask me directly. You can email me, you can chat me, you can ask your manager, or you can ask, and I'll name like two of the tech leads in the organization who I know people trust. And so I will give people ways to funnel feedback to me, whether it's anonymous or not. If it's anonymous and I really want to have a conversation, like then that becomes like a slow coaxing. You know, maybe I'm going through one of my managers just saying, if they would like to talk to me about this, you can tell them like, this is how I'm going to handle it and that you're going to hold me accountable for making sure that there's no like retaliation here. So those are things I do. The other tactics that I take on soliciting feedback, one is around like, how do you frame the question? Asking, do you have feedback for me? Are you happy with how I'm performing? Like nobody wants to tell the boss that they're not happy with how you're performing. But like, hey, I noticed that everyone has their laptops out during this like no laptop meeting. And I can tell you to put your laptops down, but clearly there's something about this meeting that seems like a waste of your time. So let's talk about that. That makes it less personal. I think people are like more likely to tell me like, oh, you just tweak this meeting and it would be fine, or get rid of this meeting, it's a waste of my time. That's not the same thing as telling me that I put together a terrible meeting. So I try to make the feedback about something other than me. And then the last thing I do is try to like pick who are the people in the org that I know will give me direct feedback on something. So like in the example of this meeting, this actually happened at Lyft. I was like running this horrible demo hour meeting that needed to be turned into an all hands. And I was having trouble making that jump that I never held an all hands for my org before. I'd never been large enough to do that. And I asked like this one guy, Ryan, on my team, who I knew would tell me what was wrong. And he, you know, gave me some ideas of like some segments that I could try. And so I refreshed the meeting and I got up in front of everybody and I said, I got some really helpful feedback from Ryan. Thank you, Ryan. Like, I realized this meeting was trash. Here's what we're going to do to fix it. And then ask people afterwards, like, did you like the segments? Did you not like the segments? Do you want new segments? And I got a lot of feedback from that. And I think it's because, well, the senior guy, Ryan, that everybody respects, he felt like he could give me feedback and I would actually do something about it. And so those are the things that I do to signal that it's like, that it's safe. I'm always going to acknowledge your feedback. I may not always listen to it, but I will always acknowledge it. And if I'm not going to listen to it, I'm going to tell you why.
What are some ways that we might be accidentally trigger signaling that we don't want feedback?
First, I think there's like a trust issue, especially if you're doing a skip level and somebody gives me feedback on something their manager said. Like, I have to ask permission before I can say like, hey, I want to have a coaching conversation with this manager over this. They're not in trouble. I think this is a great thing that I would have wanted feedback on. Is it okay if I talk about this situation with them? Because they will know that it came from you. If you don't have that conversation with them, like, you're setting yourself up for failure. Because if they don't want you to have that conversation, you may have broken trust. Sometimes I have to convince people, no, it's fine for me to have this coaching conversation with them. I really need to do it. I need you to allow me to do it. And you will not be retaliated against. And here's what would happen if you felt like you were. And so telling people like, you know, I'm not going to have any tolerance for retaliation. You come to me if you feel like they're kind of throwing it in your face in any kind of way, or they're, you know, feeling negative about you towards it. So I have had that happen. I actually have had that happen with like managers reporting to managers. Like, I have this like coaching conversation with a manager who works for me, and then he turns around and says something to the manager who works for him. And then I have to come in and say, like, it's not okay for, you know, that was like, you were supposed to be thankful for that conversation that we had rather than, you know, mad that this person didn't bring it up with you. And that, I will say, was a particular situation where I felt like it was important for me to have the conversation with him rather than coaching my skip level to have the conversation with him directly. So like, that always depends on the situation. I think the things that really signal that it's not safe to give feedback is invalidating somebody's feedback for any reason. I see this come up all the time with women, with racial minorities, where, you know, something just feels off on the team and you can't figure out why, or like someone's not treating you well and you can't figure out why. But like, I've been a woman for more than 30 years. I know sexism when I hear it. I can't always like pinpoint exactly why something is sexist. I just know it when I hear it. And so if I come to a manager and I say, or like a leader or an executive or an HR person, and I say like, I don't like this comment that was made towards me in a meeting. I thought it was very sexist. And the first thing I get is, oh, he didn't mean it like that. Now I don't trust you. Because like, you don't value my feelings. And the thing that I've learned in running orgs, and I've had to deal with, you know, people saying like, oh, I don't know, I think this team doesn't like me, and they might be sexist, they might be racist. You know, even if I think that's not the explanation for what's happening, invalidating that feeling immediately breaks a trust bond. And so helping people like process these feelings that are like, that are normal. We live in a society that's full of isms and, you know, and full of like structural inequality. And so of course there are going to be microaggressions and moments in our workday that are colored by these isms, and we have to deal with them and like, and deal with them face on. And we also have to understand that like, we're not always going to know like what was the issue on a particular team. I have one team where, this woman on the team said, I don't know what it is. I just don't feel welcome on this team. And her manager, you know, was just so quick to say like, oh, but it's not, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with your identity. We'll figure out what's going on. So like, even in that moment where, you know, her boss is convincing her that he's going to get to the root of it, he's already dismissed how she's feeling. And the nice thing in that situation was that she had a direct line to me and could come to me and tell me like, that didn't feel very good. The nice thing too was like in that org, everybody was so open about what was happening that before she even came to me, her manager had already come to me and said like, oh, I think I said the wrong thing. And so we got to have a conversation about it, and we got to actually like, I actually practiced different responses with this manager. I, you know, tried to educate him on like how, you know, how that would feel to me as a woman hearing my boss dismiss me like that. And I think we had a like reasonable outcome for everybody, which involved like some reshuffling on the team and like a lot of feedback in a bunch of different directions. You know, at the end of the day, did we like root out any racism or sexism on that team? No, but we did get her to a place where she was happier. And I think we made everybody on that team more aware of how their actions were showing up for people on the team. So I think that's a win, you know.
So Jill, I have never been mistaken for a recruiter in any situation. I don't have that experience. How might I be able to, you know, empathize with the folks on my team that have?
I mean, so much of doing the work of like inclusive leadership and really any kind of allyship is educating yourself and figuring out what are the best and most authentic ways to educate yourself. So there's like obviously like things that you can Google, but for the most part, unless you actually know people, and I mean like really know people, like have friends who have different experiences than you and people that you can have more in-depth and vulnerable conversations with, like unless you have that, it's really hard to do much other than just like, oh, hey, tell me what it's like to be a woman in engineering, which is like a question that I get all the time from men. And it's like not a particularly helpful question. And so the biggest thing that's helped, I mean, this has helped me in like building diverse teams, in making those teams inclusive and making sure that I'm credible, speaking with people of different backgrounds. A lot of it comes back to like my own network and my own friend group and like, where do I spend my time? I go to a lot of diversity events, Latinx events, Black events, women events. My friend group looks very diverse. Like sometimes I have people over at my house and I'm like, it looks like a UN meeting up in here. And so I try to have people in my life from different backgrounds so that I have the vocabulary to talk about this stuff with folks. You can tell immediately who has done even like the minimum reading on diversity and inclusion practices and who hasn't. And people can sniff this out of executives, like you know, so quickly. And they can tell when an apology is genuine and when it isn't. And for that reason, I think it's really important for any manager, but especially managers who come from majority groups, so like white people or men, to have a group of folks that they can lean on and lean on authentically. You know, if you're in my org, if you work for the same company as me and like, you know, and you have a sticky situation on your team and you just want a woman to talk it out with, I'm going to talk it out with you. But also like, you know, it would be cool if we had a relationship outside of just like me helping you through your problems and reacting to your problems that you managed to find yourself in. And so I think it's really important for us to create these connections with other managers and with people of a particular background, like for that reason. And I think you'll find like, oh, actually there are a lot of, you know, let's say like women engineering leaders that I like and respect and who I think are really good and I can learn something from them. So like when we do the work to expand our networks, I think that really helps. One thing we did at Lyft was around performance review time. We had it started with a thing where like if you were writing a self-reflection and you belong to Uplift Tech, which was our ERG for underrepresented employees, you could go to these office hours that were staffed with managers, volunteer managers who would like read through your self-reflection and help make sure that like you're advocating for yourself enough and that what's in your self-reflection is clear. We took that a step further the last two cycles that I was there and said, if you're a manager and you're writing a performance assessment for somebody and they come from some underrepresented identity and you're going to give them feedback on their communication, their demeanor, or just, you know, the way that they speak, then you need to get that reviewed by somebody from a group that we put together that we tried to make somewhat diverse. It was mostly women, but it was the women who were coming up with like, you know, like, oh, I was told I need to smile more. I was told I was abrasive. And so like that was the group that we wanted to make sure like you have an opportunity to get, you know, a set of eyes on this. And it maybe it's legitimate for you to give somebody feedback on their communication. Maybe they are actually abrasive, but here's why you shouldn't use that word. And here's why you need to actually like think about how this feedback is worded so that it lands properly and it doesn't trigger any of those feelings of like sexism that like automatically get raised anytime someone tells us that we need to be nicer to somebody. And so I think that was a really welcome offering. That's a good use of my time because I know that it's going to make a difference for women in the org getting their performance assessments. And it's a great opportunity to start forcing those connections where managers are having to seek out help from other managers and start to like form those connections where we actually get to mentor each other through some of these really sticky situations.
So you identified that communication was kind of a hotspot for kind of that gender differences, and that's why you focused on that part.
I mean, there are actual studies on this. So Kieran Snyder, who is the founder and CEO of Text.io, wrote this great article called The Abrasiveness Trap, where she analyzed a bunch of different performance reviews of men and women and found that the word abrasive was showing up in a large portion of women's reviews, but not at all in the men's. And when women were getting constructive feedback or critical feedback, they were being told to, you know, don't be so abrasive, be nicer, shut up every once in a while. Not those words, but, you know, pipe down. And the men were being told like, oh, maybe if you did this, you would be more effective. Maybe if you stopped doing so much of this and started doing this instead, you would be more effective.
More actionable.
Yeah, there was a difference in the type of constructive feedback that men and women were getting. And I remember when that article came out, I was working at a different company and it started to like make the rounds in our women's ERG. And I remember I was called abrasive in my very first performance review. And I had been called it in future performance reviews also. And it was like a thing that I was trying to deal with, just like, how, I don't know, I don't, like, I'm nicer than the men I'm working with. How come I'm being called abrasive? And just hearing woman after woman saying like, yeah, I got this feedback too. And so that's been, I look for abrasive in every performance review I ever read, in any piece of peer feedback. And if I see it, I kick it back to people and I tell them why that word is so loaded. But it is also like a thing that, you know, we were just trying to pay attention to it in our calibrations. Like, how often does the like criticism around communication come up? And does it come up more often for men versus women? And, you know, we didn't have enough data on it to say anything conclusive, but certainly we noticed that like women were getting a lot more comments on their communication from peers. And that's the thing that's tough as managers. Like, we have to actually be the ones who are skilled at rooting out bias. That's why we have to educate ourselves on cultural biases and like how to manage in multicultural environments, because we're the people who are filtering this peer feedback and putting it into an assessment and a summary. And we have a lot of control over whether somebody gets promoted or not. You know, if we walk in and say, well, nobody likes to, you know, talk to them. So, you know, then that can immediately tank their promotion chances. And so if we're not, you know, at the front line, actually like determining what's good feedback and what's garbage feedback, then, you know, we're not being very good managers for our folks.
My guest today has been Jill Wetzler. Jill, thank you for joining us on Scaling Software Teams. Thanks again to Jill for sharing her experience with us. Here are a couple takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, skip level 101s are the most effective tool we have in our toolbox for manager coaching. By going directly to our manager's reports, we can give them feedback that they're not getting right now. People are struggling and they don't know it. We can ask the right questions. We can be a neutral third party to get feedback from their team and help give them that feedback in a kind way. We can help them coach around issues, because with a skip level 101, we'll know the issues on our team. Otherwise, we're just filtering problems. We're playing telephone with the manager we're coaching and their team. We go and talk to the team. We have better perspective. We can get better coaching. One of the things Jill specifically is thoughtful about is how do you take feedback you get from a skip level 101 and give that feedback to your manager? She advocates for building trust and asking explicitly and never, ever taking something that we learned in a skip level 101 and outing one of their teammates. That destroys trust. Number two, as managers of managers, part of our job is HR. At Lyft, Jill created a specific role to interface with HR and help develop leaders. At our companies, we're not going to have that specific role. What Jill did in that role were things like reviewing a performance improvement plan to make sure it was realistic, looking at a team's velocity, the definition of velocity, and making sure that performance improvement plan was not unrealistic. That's something that would be hard for HR to do, but as a manager of managers, that's something that's important for us to do. Not to leave our first line managers out to hanging in the breeze. She would also help coach conversations like, could we talk through the process of when someone's not performing and how that might look like if they left? This sort of coaching is something on small teams that we're going to have to do for our managers. Number three, if underrepresented groups are stuck, there are things management can do. Jill's solution is to have a diverse set of trained leaders that you can go to that's not HR. These are folks that are going to have trust. They've been there. If all of your leaders look the same, it's tough for underrepresented folks to find someone they can trust and get sponsorship. An example of knowing what it's like is folks reporting that every time I come in the building, someone thinks I'm kitchen staff. Another example is folks that are female engineers that are used to be mistaken for recruiters. Thanks again to Jill for coming on the show. Now, I want to hear from you. If you have any questions about growing a remote team, please email me at wes@wovingteams.com. I read every email personally, and I'm excited to help you solve your problems. Or at least, let's talk about it. Until next week, keep on scaling.